perhaps 3 million black voters, had been concentrated in 1956, and from every available evidence, as the Democratic pollster Richard Scammon told his clients, during the next 4 years that vote will continue to increase. This possibility provided the GOP with a great opportunity to take the big states and thereby to be able to hold the White House even without an Ike at the head of the ticket. The more closely that these trends were analyzed, congressional district by congressional district, ward by ward, the more attainable that prospect appeared. The larger the Negro population in a particular district or ward, the larger had been Eisenhower's margin of gain between his two elections. The heart of New York's Negro population, for example, was the city's 16th congressional district, Harlem. And in Harlem, where once a Republican presidential candidate counted himself lucky if he received 10% of the vote, Eisenhower had received 17% in 1952 and 34% in 1956. In Illinois' first congressional district, Chicago's South Side, his share had increased from 25% to 36%. And even a 50-50 break in the up-to-now heavily Democratic Negro vote might well push key doubtful states into the Republican column, Scammon concluded. The Democrats might then be denied the White House until some new major adjustment of American political forces shifted the balance their way. And, strategists saw, a key reason for the Republican trend among African American voters remained: the Democrats' control of Capitol Hill. The Negro voter, by and large, appears convinced that it is the Democrats who prevent any legislative help in his race's striving for a better share in American democracy, the Atlantic Monthly reported. The Negro voter, and the white voter too, who feels strongly on the subject, sees only Mississippi Senator Eastland blocking the door of his powerful Judiciary Committee and backed by Southern Democrats determined to filibuster any civil rights legislation. NAACP lobbyist Clarence Mitchell, speaking to NAACP branches across the country during the 1956 campaign, had said that a heavy Negro vote for Republicans would automatically eliminate 21 Southern chairmen from the key committee posts they now hold. Campaigning in Harlem, Vice President Richard Nixon had told audiences that civil rights legislation cannot pass as long as the filibuster exists in the Senate. He also said that if Eisenhower was elected, "We are going to have performance on civil rights, not just promises, because Eisenhower is going to have a vice president who opposes the filibuster." The effectiveness of such pleas had been documented in the upsurge in the GOP vote in Harlem. Said Mitchell after the campaign, "Seldom in the long political history of our country has a man been so helpful in defeating members of his own party as Eastland." Democrats knew Mitchell was right. Returning to Washington from Oregon, where he and his wife, Maureen, had made more than 350 speeches urging the re-election of Wayne Morse, Richard Neuberger said that although less than 2% of Oregon's population is colored, "We are continually confronted with the charge that a vote for Senator Morse was a vote to continue Senator Eastland as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee." There was a further disturbing note for Democrats. The concentration of Northern Negro voters in the city's ghetto wards, together with gerrymandering that kept the Negro vote confined to those wards, meant that the shift in that vote toward the GOP had not yet been heavily felt in elections below the presidential level. But as U.S. News and World Report said, if the shift continues, it could affect the choice of aldermen, city councilmen, and scores of House members. This kind of political fallout in Negro precincts is causing major recalculations of party strength all over America. The recalculations were going on in both parties. Once a basic Democratic belief had been that the party could not afford to alienate the South. Now there was a new calculation. The 11 Southern states had a total of 128 electoral votes, and that figure included Texas, which Eisenhower had carried twice, and whose 24 electoral votes could no longer be considered safe for a Democratic presidential candidate. Without Texas, the South's electoral vote was 104. The 9 key northern states had 223 electoral votes. Accustomed, though Capitol Hill had become, to discounting Hubert Humphrey's extravagant rhetoric, His remark that the Democrats were digging their own grave brought many nods in Democratic offices. The civil rights dilemma loads down the Democrats in the North as the old man of the sea sat athwart the shoulders of Sinbad the Sailor, said Senator Neuberger. Unless the party's stance on that issue was changed, the result could be banishment for the Democrats for many decades from the executive branch of government. Long indispensable, the South might, suddenly, now be expendable. And while Democrats were constrained from taking full advantage of these new calculations by another reality, a change in the party's stance might alienate the committee chairman who were so important a source of its strength, no such constraint operated on the GOP. Republicans had little to lose and a great deal to gain. "Give us a civil rights bill," one Republican leader told James Reston, "and by 1960 we will break the Roosevelt coalition of the large cities in the South, even without Eisenhower." No sooner had the 1956 election results been analyzed than Republican leaders began laying plans to exploit the situation. And among these leaders were the party's two leading candidates to succeed Eisenhower, both of whom, as it happened, were from California, with its 194,000 Negro voters, which meant that both men had been sensitized to the potentials of black voting power, and both of whom, as it happened, were there in the Senate chamber with Lyndon Johnson, one of them, William Noland, seated just across the aisle from him, the other, Richard Nixon, on the low dais just a few feet away, his eyes almost level with those of the tall majority leader. Noland, the Taft acolyte whose passion for civil rights had heretofore been extremely well concealed, now unequivocally promised the NAACP's Mitchell that he would lead the fight to pass a civil rights bill in 1957. As for Noland's rival, as Marquis Childs said, "One thing even Nixon's bitterest enemies have never denied him. That is a sure understanding of the main chance." And, Childs wrote, Nixon was "working with all the intensity of a very intense nature, trying to shape for his party a strategy to position it on the right side of the issue that contributed more than any other to the Republican landslide of last November." Nixon's ally, of course, was Brownell, and the Republican Attorney General had lost none of his enthusiasm for his proposed bill that would give the Justice Department unprecedented power to enforce a broad array of civil rights. The bill in whose inherent aims and political possibilities he deeply believed. Within a few days after the election, it was known that the Brownell bill would be reintroduced in 1957. In 1956, it had been introduced late in the session, late enough for the Senate to avoid confronting it. But the Senate would not be able to avoid confronting it again. Since the 1956 election, there had been a further escalation of white hostility in the South. When the new school year had begun in September, before the election, there had been only minor progress in the 17 states which, before the Brown decision, had required school segregation. Of the 2,731,750 Negro school children who were in school that September in the 17 states, some 115,000, 4%, were in schools also attended by whites. And even that small figure was misleading, for almost all of those 115,000 were in border states. In the 11 former Confederate states, 3,400 of Texas's 248,000 Negroes were in integrated schools. A total of 1,200 more were in integrated schools in Arkansas or Tennessee. 3 years after Brown, that was the extent of Southern compliance with the court's decree. And as John Bartlow Martin found on his tour through the South that fall, in recent months resistance to school desegregation has been hardening. In most of the Deep South, he reported, there is no prospect of school integration in the foreseeable future. State legislatures would be convening in January, and scores of bills had been introduced that would have the effect of nullifying the educational integration decree. In Virginia, they were introduced by legislative members of the Byrd machine. There was no time to lose, Harry Byrd said. A federal judge had issued a ruling designed to force integration in Virginia. We face the gravest crisis since the war between the states. If laws were not passed to circumvent the ruling, he said, 6-year-old children of both races would be assembled in little huts before the bus comes, and the bus will then be packed like sardines. What our people most fear is that by this close, intimate social contact, future generations will intermarry. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee called for massive resistance to all such court rulings. Law enforcement, he said, should be by the white people of this country. Other bills dealt with voting, intending to make it more difficult for African Americans to register. Not that such legislation seemed particularly urgent, for while black voting had been rising sharply in the North, in the South, voting statistics were little more encouraging than those on schools. Among the more than 6 million Negroes in the 11 Southern states who were 21 years of age in 1956, only 1,238,000 had been registered, still only 1 in 5. There were entire counties in these states, counties in which thousands of Negroes lived, in which not a single Negro was registered to vote. In Mississippi, the number of registered Negroes may actually have declined during those 4 years. Further increases seemed likely to come even more slowly. 5 states still had a poll tax, and in all the Southern states, the use of literacy tests and of outright intimidation, economic and or physical, was increasing. A new tactic, wholesale challenges by Citizens Council's representatives of Negro voters on a county's registration lists, had been instituted in 1956, and it had proven effective. In one Louisiana parish, more than 3,000 of the 4,000 registered Negroes had been purged from the registration books shortly before the 1956 election, and its use was expected to increase. The number of Negroes who actually voted in the South may actually have been smaller in 1956 than in 1952. Nor was it only in schools and voting that the South was strengthening its defenses. The legislative hoppers of the South are spilling over with legislation aimed at keeping the Negro in his place, Stan Opatowski of the New York Post found on a tour of the South in December 1956. One bill that was about to be introduced and passed in Louisiana specifically prohibited the performance of George Gershwin's musical Porgy and Bess, since it raised the possibility of blacks and whites appearing on the same stage. It also prohibited the annual meeting of the state Red Cross, since a previous annual meeting had been attended by Negroes and whites. Anger was escalating everywhere in the South. In the White Citizens' Councils, the South had found, in John Bartlow Martin's phrase, a flag to rally round. And in 1956, as in 1955, tens of thousands of white Southerners joined their rolls. One huge rally followed another. The council's vigilance extended into areas previously not thought of. Incensed that some of Southern Bell's party lines were used by both black and white subscribers, Mississippi's Monroe County Council demanded that the company segregate its telephones. The council's targets included not only Negroes, but white Southerners whose racial views, while perhaps not pro-integration, were unacceptably moderate. They too, Opatowski found, are subjected to the same terror if they dare stray from the most rigid segregation line. There is a consistent and insistent attempt to force all white Southerners into a rigid pattern of defiance of the courts and to a position of rigidity on every aspect of the race question, said Morris B. Abram, president of the American Jewish Committee. And these enormous pressures, Abram said, were succeeding. The field is being preempted by the extremists. The White Citizens' Councils had the South, the White South as well as the Black, firmly in its grip. The domination is total, Opatowski wrote. There is no middle ground, no shade of gray, only black and white. And woe betide the black. Reported Martin, the Deep South is solid once more. Even more ominously, a growing number of Southern whites were not satisfied with the Council's actions. There was, the New York Times reported that December, an upsurge by the frustrated elements that want more boldness and action. The Ku Klux Klan, in disrepute for more than a decade because of its violent redneck tactics, was again on the rise. That fall, Martin reported, it has burned crosses in the fields and paraded openly through many a small town. And the Klan, as Opatowski pointed out, does not claim the niceties which the councils wear as their mantle. They're back to flogging again. In one incident in Camden, South Carolina, a white 52-year-old high school music teacher was taken from his car, tied to a tree, and beaten with tree limbs and with a wooden plank by a group of men in white hoods, because it was thought that he had advocated school integration. Only later was it learned that the beating had been given to the wrong man. The music teacher had, in fact, opposed integration. Everywhere in the South, violence was rising. That November and December 1956, in the wake of the victory in Montgomery, it had been a week after the November election that the Supreme Court ruled Alabama's bus segregation ordinances unconstitutional. Negroes had begun bus boycotts in other southern cities and were trying to integrate schools and parks as well. Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization created to launch civil rights protests all across the South, was organizing for its first meeting, which would be held in Atlanta on January 10th. Southern whites were reacting to this new black determination with new fury. The bombings of Negro homes and churches increased. More snipers fired on integrated buses. In one incident in Montgomery, a Negro woman was wounded in the leg, and when more shots were fired at the bus, it headed for a police station with its passengers lying on the floor. There were new attempts on King's life and family, including a shotgun blast fired into their home while they were sleeping. In Birmingham, Fred Shuttlesworth had announced that he and other Negroes would sit in the front rows of city buses on the day after Christmas. On Christmas night, a bundle of 15 sticks of dynamite exploded beneath Shuttlesworth's parsonage. The next day, he and a score of other Negroes were arrested on the buses. Police in other Alabama cities also ignored the Supreme Court ruling, arresting Negroes who sat in front. On the eve of the 1957 session of Congress, Southern bombings, beatings, sniper fire, and cross burnings were not stopping, but increasing. The perpetrators evidently felt they could act with impunity, and again they were proven correct. Every time black leaders asked Brownell to take action to stop the violence, the Attorney General had to reply that under existing law, the authority for maintaining interstate law and order rested with the states, not the federal government. Two white men had actually been arrested for one of the bombings of Martin Luther King's home and had given and signed confessions. A Montgomery jury, all white naturally, had acquitted them nonetheless. "Deep Southern resistance," John Bartlow Martin wrote, "is righteous, determined, and sure of success. At the outset, it probably was buying time. Not today, and they believe they have desegregation stopped. This is not a few loudmouth rabble-rousing politicians. This is all but unanimous white opposition." He had taken a tour of the South to determine when the South might integrate its schools, and he gave his conclusion in the title of the book he wrote, "The Deep South Says Never." The region's attitude was personified in the Georgian who in 1956 drove gentlemanly old Walter George out of the Senate. George's new senator was Herman Talmadge, son of Gene Talmadge, hero of the Wool Hats, the Georgia governor who during the 1930s and 40s had been the incarnation of the suspender-snapping, tobacco-chewing Southern race baiter. While he had not actually been a member of the Klan, Gene once said, "I used to do a little whipping myself." Herman was smoother, but just as unabashed a segregationist. As governor, he sponsored a state constitutional amendment allowing Georgia to close her public schools rather than desegregate them, and to send white and Negro children to separate private schools. Sitting contentedly in his stately home, filled with echoes of the Civil War, "When we remodeled, we dug a few old Minié balls out of the house. The only reason it was not burned was that Sherman occupied it," he told Martin, "they couldn't send enough bayonets down here to compel the people to send their children to school with niggers." Talmadge's election to the United States Senate in November 1956 was by the biggest majority in Georgia's history. To Clarence Mitchell, says Mitchell's biographer, "the supplanting of George by Talmadge was a tragedy that reaffirmed the South's intention to stick to its unconstitutional way of life." The South was determined that its position on segregation would in fact be hardened, that this new civil rights agitation would be defeated. And when Southern strategists surveyed the situation, they were confident that it would be defeated. For, after all, if all else failed, they still had their Senate citadel, where they still held their chairmanships and their subcommittees. When Congress reconvened in January, it would be faced again by the Brownell bill. But although that bill had been passed by the House in 1956, it had been blocked in the Senate, and if necessary, it would be blocked there again. And back in the states of the Southern senators, the rising rebel yell was not for compromise, but for victory. Lyndon Johnson was in residence at the Johnson Ranch over Christmas vacation in December 1956. So early each morning, Mary Rather would walk down to the Purdenalis, passing the family cemetery with its big live oak, and then across the river on the low water bridge to collect the mail from the large, slightly tilted mailbox. That December, late in the month, among the missives that Ms. Rather found in the mail and left on the dining room table for her boss to open over breakfast, were three communications that were definitely not Christmas greetings. They were warnings. Warnings in the form of memoranda that Lyndon Johnson took very seriously because of the identity of the men who had written them. Each of the three memoranda warned him that he must act on civil rights and act soon. And each memo told him also what might never happen if he failed to act. One of the memoranda, mailed from Washington on December 20th, was from the man with whom he could not afford to argue. And it demonstrated that among people committed to the cause of social justice, not even personal affection could blunt the issue. Philip Graham had discussed the memo with his wife before sending it. In her memoirs, she would describe it as arguing that the senator needed to counteract the reputation he had as a conservative, sectional politician. The memorandum itself said that Johnson's past response to this false stereotype has been largely negative. He complains about phony liberals, he criticizes columnists and some other parts of the press, etc. And, Philip Graham told Johnson bluntly, that reaction hadn't worked, and it was never going to. The only way for Johnson to change his stereotype, Graham wrote, was for him to announce a legislative program that would make possible a congressional session marked by a high order of accomplishment. The program, Graham wrote, would have several principal themes, of which an essential one, Catherine Graham would call it perhaps the most important, was civil rights. Civil rights to be strengthened, not by phony speech-making, but by consequential action, Graham wrote. It is essential for LBJ to create and articulate a realistic philosophy on civil rights, a new civil rights program which can be embraced by people of all persuasions and which can bring reality to this general field. Bluntly, Philip Graham warned Lyndon Johnson of the consequences of not acting on civil rights. Fate's decree may be that LBJ is destined only to be a Jimmy Burns or a more energetic Dick Russell, he said. On the other hand, he may be permitted to play a truly consequential role in the mainstream of history. The only way to test the possibilities is to test them, he said. At the moment, LBJ is not doing so. The other two memos were both from the man who Johnson thought was the person who might make him Pope or God knows what. 4 months earlier at the Chicago Convention, Jim Rowe had warned him in writing not to become another Dick Russell, had told him that if he presented an image of a Southern candidate, it will make it almost impossible for Lyndon Johnson to be nominated in 1960, had said that he knew that such an image is Lyndon Johnson's private nightmare. Now, in December, Rowe warned Johnson, in writing, in two memoranda dated December 13th and 21st, that the nightmare was coming true. There is, Rowe said, a growing public impression that you are the leader of the Southern conservatives. This has long worried me, and I know it worries you too, Rowe said. Nonetheless, he said, it is clear to me that enough has not been done to change or stop or turn this impression. All you and I have done essentially is to point out to each other that this picture is utterly untrue. We are inclined to dismiss it. And he told Johnson, you cannot afford to dismiss it if you want to win the presidential nomination. It is time that we accept the obvious truth that a public impression is just as much a fact as anything else. That impression must be changed, quickly. To accomplish this, Rowe had a number of suggestions. Some were social. Harry Truman and Adlai Stevenson will be in Washington immediately after the first of the year, he told Johnson, and you should invite them over for a drink and conciliate them. Think of what they can do to you if they are hostile. If these two men would wish to wrap the Southern candidate tag around your neck, you would have a terrible time trying to get rid of it. And some were strategic, of which the key one was that he immediately put the newly elected Democratic senator from Colorado, former Representative John Carroll, a liberal and ardent civil libertarian, on the Judiciary Committee. Your problem in the Senate in 1957 will be twofold, Roe wrote. The first is to avoid becoming the symbol of the South, and the second was linked with the first. To cut the ground out from the Northern liberals by at least appearing to cooperate with them. So on civil rights, Roe said, you should be ready to give the civil libertarians something which they already have. Carroll's appointment to judiciary would accomplish this because it would be meaningless, Roe said. The appointment of a civil liberty senator to the judiciary is nothing special because they already have a large majority on the committee. Johnson had Reedy write Roe a letter temporizing on the appointment, and Roe didn't press the subject, but in subsequent telephone calls he did press the larger point, that to win the 1960 nomination, Johnson must make himself more acceptable to the North, and the only way to do that was by passing civil rights legislation. Otherwise, as Roe was to say in an interview years later, the Northern bosses were just not going to take him. The Negro problem just wouldn't allow it. The memoranda were not the only warnings from Washington delivered on the same subject to the Johnson Ranch that December. At least one other came in a telephone call from the Capitol from another man whose advice Lyndon Johnson took very seriously. Tommy Corcoran was, as always, much blunter and less diplomatic than his partner, Roe, and told Johnson flatly, he was to recall, if he didn't pass a civil rights bill, he could just forget the 1960 nomination. These were warnings to a man who didn't need warnings. Johnson already knew what he had to do in 1957, Roe says. As Doris Kearns Goodwin was to write, the issue of civil rights had created a crisis of legitimacy for both the Senate and the Democratic Party. And therefore, the issue was a crisis for Lyndon Johnson. In a sense, in the journalistic view, the public view, Lyndon Johnson was the Senate, its majority leader, the senator who would be held responsible for its actions. If the Senate appeared ineffectual, incapable of dealing with the issue, he would appear ineffectual, incapable. If it appeared sectional, Southern, racist, he would appear sectional, Southern, racist. Furthermore, as far as the Senate was concerned, he was the Democratic Party. If the party looked ineffectual or racist, the blame would fall on his head. If the party split, the chasm between Southern and Northern senators becoming unbridgeable, the responsibility for that would fall on his head also. And the issue was, in addition, a crisis for him in terms of his personal ambition. As Goodwin wrote, as a man with presidential dreams, Johnson recognized that it would be almost impossible for him to escape all responsibility for the Senate to act, that failure on this issue at this time would brand him forever as sectional and therefore unpresidential. Lyndon Johnson had no choice, and he knew it. Recalling the situation years later, he would say, one thing had become absolutely certain. The Senate simply had to act. The Democratic Party simply had to act. And I simply had to act. The issue could wait no longer. Something had to be done, he said. He understood as well the consequence of failure on this issue. I knew, he said, that if I failed to produce on this one, my leadership would be broken into 100 pieces. Everything I had built up over the years would be completely undone. Producing on civil rights seemed almost impossibly difficult, however. To win the Democratic presidential nomination, Lyndon Johnson had to keep the support of the South. And the key to keeping that support was not passing civil rights legislation, but rather stopping it from being passed. Moreover, despite his success in chipping away some of the South's power in the Senate and concentrating it in his hands, the South's senatorial power was still immense. In 1957, Southerners would be the chairman of no fewer than 5 of the Senate's 8 most powerful standing committees, and their ally Hayden would be chairman of a 6th, Appropriations. On the key committees and subcommittees, they were stacked, in fact, more deeply than ever. On Appropriations, for example, there would be in 1957, in addition to Chairman Hayden, 11 other Democratic members. 8 were Southerners, 2 were senators who voted with the South on appropriation bills. Exactly 1, the most junior member, was a vote of which the Southerners could not be confident. Even if he decided to pass a bill, could he pass it? In a confrontation with the majority leader, the chairman might still win. And it was not winning that was the most crucial point, for if there was a confrontation between Johnson and the South, Johnson might no longer be majority leader. The leader was elected by the Democratic caucus. In 1957, there would be 49 Democratic senators, so only 25 votes, a majority of the 49, would be necessary to remove him and pick a new leader. Even without his own vote and that of the other Texas senator, Price Daniel, and possibly Gore of Tennessee, the South would still have 19 or 20 of the necessary 25 votes, and it could always muster the few necessary additional votes from its allies. And where would he get votes? From the liberals, whose every meeting was an exercise in denouncing him? From the liberals like Paul Douglas, whom he had repeatedly humiliated? Even if Johnson changed his stance on civil rights, could he really count on liberal support? And how many liberal votes were there in the Democratic caucus anyway? 9 or 10 for certain, that was all. If the South turned against him, he could be voted out of the leadership very easily. Nor would voting him out even be necessary. The South had not found it necessary to remove Scott Lucas or Ernest McFarland as majority leader. The South had simply refused to cooperate with them, and without the South's cooperation, those two men had been ineffectual, objects of ridicule. The South could do the same to Lyndon Johnson. Even if Johnson was to decide to confront the South and try to pass legislation over its opposition, was such a course feasible? Even if all the other defenses that the South could erect against civil rights legislation were somehow breached, there would remain still that last defense, the strongest of all, the defense that decade after decade had proven impregnable. Even if Lyndon Johnson decided to try to break a filibuster, could it be broken? With more senators than ever before sympathetic to the plight of black Americans, and with more Republican support due to both conscience and calculation, a civil rights bill might well command a majority of votes in the Senate. But would the bill be allowed to come to a vote? There might be a majority for passage. Would there be the necessary 2/3 for cloture? Western senators of both parties were supportive, sometimes only lukewarmly, of civil rights, but were adamantly opposed to cloture, since the right of unlimited debate was their state's ultimate protection. Some conservative Republicans from the Midwest believe that even the mildest civil rights legislation is wrong, George Reedy notes. They might nonetheless be pressured by the White House into voting for such legislation, he says, but that did not mean they could also be pressured into voting for cloture. Unlimited debate is regarded as an absolute principle by many senators, Reedy wrote. It is not just a dodge to keep civil rights legislation from passage. On the eve of the 85th Congress, some liberals were saying, as they had on the eve of the 84th Congress, and the 83rd, and on the eve of Congresses going back for years before that, that there was a real chance that this time there would be enough votes to impose cloture. But among more realistic Capitol Hill observers, there was considerable doubt about that. Only 33 votes or absences were necessary to defeat cloture. When to the 19 or 20 Southern votes were added the votes of conservative Northeastern Republicans like Stiles Bridges and John Marshall Butler and others, and conservative Midwestern Republicans like Hickenlooper and Bricker and Jenner and Thigh and Capehart and Curtis and Sheppel and Ruska and Young and others, and Western senators like Hayden and Goldwater and Allen Bible and Malone and Henry Dworshak and others, you got up to 33 real fast, as one vote counter was to explain, even without including those senators who mouthed a support for civil rights that they did not feel in their hearts. Years later, putting down his thoughts in a definitive way, George Reedy was to write, "They, the Southerners, unquestionably had the power to defeat, through filibuster, any or all civil rights proposals, and there was no prospect whatsoever of shutting off their filibuster through a cloture move." The last civil rights law had passed in 1875. During the 82 intervening years, 8 decades, 4 generations, some civil rights bills had passed the House, 5 since the end of the war alone, not 1 had passed the Senate. and passing a civil rights bill in the Senate in 1957 seemed as difficult, almost impossible, as ever. There was yet another consideration, the most daunting of all. A successful Southern filibuster would wreck Johnson's chances of winning the nomination, but so would an unsuccessful filibuster. The very launching of a filibuster would not only emphasize the split in his party, it would force him, as the Senate's procedural leader, to take a stand on one side or the other, to take steps either to support it or to end it. From the moment one began, there was no way to avoid taking a stand. If he did nothing, took no action to stop the filibuster and simply let it go on, he would be supporting it, standing with the South, and he would never get the Northern support he needed for the nomination. Moving to cut the filibuster off, moving for cloture, would cost him the support of the South. To produce on civil rights, therefore, he would have to pass civil rights legislation that had invariably provoked the start of a filibuster whenever there was a chance of its passage, without allowing a filibuster to start. He had to persuade the members of the Southern Caucus, not only somewhat open-minded Southerners like Hill and Sparkman and Fulbright, but also Jim Eastland, to whom black Americans were unbearably stinking and who was chairman of Judiciary, and Olin Johnston, who had refused a dinner invitation because his wife might have to sit next to a black person, and who was chairman of Post Office, and Harry Byrd, chairman of Finance, who had called for massive resistance to civil rights laws lest there be close, intimate contact between white and black children, and Alan Ellender, chairman of Agriculture, who studded his speeches with the word nigger, and Spessard Holland, the true racist, and John Stennis, a racist smarter than but equally rabid as his predecessor Bilbo. He had to persuade them all, not to mention the newcomers' Talmage. They couldn't send enough bayonets down here to compel the people to send their children to school with negras. And Thurmond, I will never favor mixing the races. Lyndon Johnson had to persuade these senators of the Old South, with all their power and all their hate, to allow a civil rights bill to become law without using their most effective weapon. He had one thing going for him, the Southerners' desire to make him president. New fuel had been added to Richard Russell's determination to put Lyndon Johnson in the White House by the injustice he had seen perpetrated on Johnson at the Democratic Convention. The same injustice that had been perpetrated on him at the 1952 convention, and for the same reason, Northern prejudice against his beloved Southland. And Chicago had also given Russell fresh proof that his plans for Johnson required the erasure from the Texan's image of at least some of the Southern tint, and that there was only one possible way to erase it. This was made clear to George Reedy one evening in mid-November in a very unlikely locale, a small bistro in Paris. Aware that his presidential hopes required him to show more interest in foreign affairs, Johnson had reluctantly added his name to a senatorial delegation to a NATO conference in Paris. Russell was a member of the delegation, and Johnson brought Reedy along. Russell and Reedy were having a companionable dinner by themselves at the bistro when suddenly, out of nowhere, Russell said, "George, we're going to get that man elected president yet." Then, Reedy recalls, there was a long pause, which was broken at last by Russell. "But we can never make him president unless the Senate first disposes of civil rights," Richard Russell said. The Grahams were not the only important visitors to the Johnson Ranch that December. Russell, accompanied by his favorite nephew, Bobby, came too, not at the same time as the Grahams, of course. Russell's itinerary during his 5 days in Texas included the trips to St. Joseph Island and the Brown and Root Ranch at Falfurrias that he had come to enjoy. But it included as well several long walks alone with Johnson. What the two senators discussed during those walks, no one knows. When they went off down there, they went off by themselves, says Posh Oltorf, who had now become a full-time Brown and Root lobbyist. But it was to become apparent from their aftermath that the conservative Southerner Richard Russell was as fully aware as the liberal Southerner Philip Graham that for Lyndon Johnson to have a chance to become president, he would first have to be cleaned up on civil rights. And it was to become apparent as well that to accomplish that objective, Russell had decided to give Johnson some leeway, to cut some slack in the ties that had bound him to the South. How little leeway was to become apparent even before the session, however. because in December it became known that the key issue at the start of Congress would be again, as it was at the start of each new Congress, Rule 22, the gravedigger in the Senate graveyard for civil rights bills, which required 64 votes to limit debate, and which also provided that there could be no limit at all on a motion to proceed to a change in the rules. Russell's reaction to Humphrey's declaration that a new attempt would be made to change Rule 22 was cold anger at this liberal to whom he had been so tolerant. He told Johnson he wanted Humphrey cut off completely from access to the Senate leadership, and the leadership acquiesced. Humphrey quickly realized that word had been passed that he was to get the cold shoulder, and he got it not only from the Southerners but from his friend from Texas. With his usual warmth, Humphrey walked up to Johnson, but was met with a chilliness that stopped just short of being an outright snub. Saying, "You broke faith with me," Johnson turned and walked away. Humphrey's reaction was instant grovel. "Now, Lyndon, you know I wouldn't do that," he said in an abject phone call. "You can get more votes out of this body than anybody can. You are a great, great leader, Lyndon. I was simply trying to make you an even better leader." When this personal obeisance proved insufficient, Humphrey had an aide approach Bobby Baker to ascertain the price of peace, and it was promptly paid. The surrender was reported in an Associated Press dispatch about a speech Humphrey delivered in New York City, in which Senator Humphrey took a decidedly different tack from that of other liberal Democrats who recently have urged greater militancy in seeking liberal legislation. The difference was indeed decided. More progress would be made, Humphrey said, if liberals became less militant. The question, he said, is, do you want to make progress or do you want to fight? Sometimes, he said, you have to be willing to inch along. And he made it clear that on one issue he was certainly not willing to fight. I'm not going to spend all my time fighting the Senate rules. The dispute with Lyndon Johnson? As one of Humphrey's biographers puts it, in a few days it was patched up. During the dispute, furthermore, a Washington Post reporter asked Johnson if he himself favors any change in the filibuster rule, and Johnson, the reporter wrote, replied with a flat no. Before the 1957 congressional session had begun, Johnson had lined up in support of the measure that was the highest barrier to civil rights legislation. He had also, before leaving for Paris, tried to take another step to solidify the South's Senate defenses. Earl Clements's loss had left vacant the post of majority whip. There were both liberal and Southern candidates for the job, and Johnson's choice was a Southerner, George Smathers. Telephoning Smathers at his Miami home, Johnson said, "I want to meet you up here tomorrow at 11 o'clock." "I can't get there by then," Smathers said. "God damn it, you can get there," Johnson replied. Smathers did, checking into the Mayflower Hotel. But on the flight north, he decided not to take the job, partly because his chairmanship of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee had already given him a taste of Johnson's demands on subordinates, and he simply did not want to continue working that hard, but also because if he accepted the post, the South would hold both top Democratic senatorial leadership positions, and this, he felt, might invite trouble. The next morning, a Mayflower desk clerk telephoned up to Smathers' room to tell him that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Baker were on the way up. "There's a knock, and there they are," Smathers was to recall. "Johnson's there in a raincoat. It was cold. He had a big cowboy Texas hat on, and Bobby was with him. Bobby usually was." Taking it for granted that Smathers would accept the assistant leader's job, Johnson began issuing instructions. Smathers said, "I don't want to be your assistant." And he was never to forget what followed. It was just as though you had unleashed an awful smell of something. His nostrils flared, his eyes sort of looked funny. He said, "What are you saying?" I said, "I don't know that I want to be the whip." He said, "Do you really mean that?" He hadn't sat down the whole time, neither did Bobby. We were all standing. I said, "Yeah, Johnson, I don't know that I want to do it." So he said, "Come on, Bobby, let's go." Despite this setback, Johnson gave the post to Mike Mansfield of Montana, a highly respected but unassertive Westerner who Johnson was sure would follow his instructions and who, time noted, had been a special protege of Walter George. On the eve of the 1957 session, Johnson appeared to be standing shoulder to shoulder with the enemies of civil rights, as he had been standing with them for more than 20 years. The session's opening days did nothing to modify that impression. Johnson's actions during those days furnished new evidence that while he may have been cut a little slack by the South, he hadn't been cut much, that he was still going to be operating at the end of a very tight rope. During those days, he moved effectively not for a civil rights bill, but against it. At a January 2nd meeting in Paul Douglas's office on the ground floor of the Senate office building, the liberals had decided that Clinton Anderson would offer the same motion he had introduced in 1953, and would have reintroduced in 1955 had not Johnson tricked the liberals out of doing so. That deceptively simple motion to have the Senate adopt rules for the current session. And this year the liberals had a new ally, a very shrewd one. So high had the stakes become in the civil rights game that Richard Milhouse Nixon had decided to take a hand himself at the game's big table, the Senate. To sit in on the game, literally, by taking the presiding officer's chair on the Senate dais at crucial moments, including the game's opening hand. Aware of the Republican aim, of Nixon's aim, of winning the African-American vote, Senate liberals had privately sounded out the vice president, and he had privately let them know he would be on their side. It had therefore been agreed that as soon as Anderson made his motion, Douglas and other liberal senators would ask Nixon to rule on whether it was in order, on whether, in other words, the adoption of new Senate rules was permissible. And Douglas would also ask Nixon, under what rules is the Senate presently proceeding? Nixon would then rule that the motion was in order, because it would be in order under normal parliamentary rules. And he would rule further that the Senate was at that moment proceeding under standard parliamentary rules, because it was not a continuing body but a new Senate which had not yet adopted any rules of its own. Anderson's motion, coupled with Nixon's ruling, would carry in it the seeds of death for the filibuster. Under standard parliamentary rules, all votes are decided by a simple majority. If Nixon held that the Senate was operating under those rules, not only could Anderson's motion be passed by a simple majority, but if the South tried to filibuster against it, a liberal cloture motion to cut off that filibuster could also be passed by a simple majority. And then, approval having thereby been given to adopt new rules, a motion to adopt a new Rule 22, stating that cloture could be imposed by a simple majority, could be introduced. And if a filibuster against that motion was begun, a simple majority would suffice to defeat it. Russell, well aware of the threat, was aware also that the GOP, all too willing to pander to the NAACP, might well make the vote on Anderson's motion a party issue for its 47 senators, and that even Republican senators unenthusiastic about civil rights, and even less enthusiastic about making cloture easier, might support their vice president on an issue that might make them the majority party and give them the chairman's gavels. Under Nixon's ruling, not 64 but only 49 votes would be needed for passage of Anderson's motion, and there might well be 49 votes to pass it. Russell reacted by convening the Southern Caucus. Behind the closed doors of his office, on the second floor of the SOB, almost directly over Douglas's office, resentment over Judge Nixon's tactics spilled over, but Russell, emerging to meet a hall full of reporters, was urbane and confident, giving, one reporter wrote, a classic performance of a Southern politician uttering hard words in a soft manner. His only hint of criticism was directed at Nixon. Vice presidents have always been trying to change the rules of the Senate over which they have no control, he said. Otherwise, stated another reporter, Russell was calm and easygoing. He managed, nonetheless, to make it clear that if Anderson's motion for new rules carried, there would be a filibuster, a king-size one. If the Senate decided it could change rules, he said, then Rule 22 would not be the only rule changed. We would then have to start with Rule 1 and write a completely new set of rules of the Senate. We would start from scratch. Changes in every one of the Senate's other 39 rules would be introduced. And as the New York Times reported, Senator Russell suggested that in this process, legislative business of the Senate might be halted. Extended debate would be held on every proposed change, he said, forcing a separate cloture proceeding on every one. Even if votes could be obtained for the passage of 39 cloture motions, the process would tie up the Senate completely for months. In fact, Russell said, if this Pandora's box was opened, there would be no way, as I see it, to bring the debate to a close. He didn't employ the word ever, but the word was implicit. But even as Russell was describing the Pandora card, he knew that playing it was not going to be required. He had another even better ace up his sleeve, one that he knew would take the opening hand, because he had played it before in the opening hand of 1953, and it had taken the hand then. It was an ace that could not be played by him, but only by the majority leader. In 1953, the then-majority leader Taft had played it. Now in 1957, the majority leader was Lyndon Johnson, and Johnson played it too. He played it the next day. Anderson introduced his motion. The Liberals were expecting to make the next move as well. The moment Anderson finished speaking, Douglas and Humphrey were on their feet, waving their arms, requesting recognition from Nixon so that they could ask for the pre-planned ruling. But the two Liberals' desks were in the far bend of the Democratic arc. Even as Douglas and Humphrey jumped up, a commanding figure rose in front of them, in the center of the floor. Lyndon Johnson was on his feet directly in front of the dais, almost eye to eye with the vice president, demanding the prior recognition that was the majority leader's prerogative. Nixon had no choice but to recognize him first, and when the vice president did so, Johnson made his own motion, to table Anderson's motion. Russell's ace took the pot in 1957 as it had in 1953. Since Anderson's motion was no longer the pending business before the Senate, Johnson's motion took precedence over it. Humphrey and Douglas could not ask for a ruling on it as they had planned to do, but could make only a parliamentary inquiry as to what would happen if it became the pending business, and Nixon could not give a ruling but only an advisory opinion. In his opinion, the vice president came down strongly on the side of civil rights. The Constitution, he said, stated that each house could determine its own rules, and this constitutional right may be exercised by a majority of the Senate at any time. When the membership of the Senate changes, as it does upon the election of each Congress, it is the chair's opinion that there can be no question that the majority of the new existing membership can determine the rules. Therefore, he said, any Senate rule adopted in a previous Congress, which denies the right of a majority of a new Senate to adopt rules, is, in the opinion of the chair, unconstitutional. And he added, in the opinion of the chair, specifically, Rule 22 is unconstitutional. But Johnson's motion made Nixon's opinion irrelevant. Had the vice president been allowed to rule that Anderson's motion was in order, a vote on that motion not only would have been a vote with clear-cut, even dramatic civil rights implications, because it struck at the hated filibuster, but would also have been in effect a vote on Nixon's ruling, and would therefore have attracted heavy Republican support. He was their vice president, and he was going to be their candidate for president in 1960, and a substantial number of Republicans would vote to support him because of that, Howard Schuman explains. Their votes, added to the votes of liberal Democrats, might have added up to the necessary 49, the necessary majority, and for the first time in decades there would have been a realistic possibility of obtaining a civil rights bill. That, a vote on Anderson's motion, was our big chance, Schuman says. Johnson's maneuver, however, meant that not Anderson's motion, but his own tabling motion would be voted on first. And that vote would not be on Nixon's decision, and not directly on civil rights, but only on tabling, a procedural matter difficult to explain to voters. Johnson's work for the South during those first days of January 1957 was not confined to parliamentary maneuvers. He threw onto the Senate table not only the ace that Richard Russell had placed in his hand, but some cards of his own, cards on which the face was the naked face of senatorial power. The cards were played against liberal members of his own party to reduce Democratic support for civil rights to a minimum, and the cards were played with a ruthlessness that was striking in the rawness of its violation of what remained of the Senate's seniority system. The meeting of Johnson's rubber-stamped Democratic Steering Committee, which made committee assignments, had been abruptly postponed until January 7th, so that it would come after the vote on the tabling motion. And in more than one instance, assignments were made on the basis not of seniority, but of a senator's vote on that motion. In the case of senators whose vote had been in doubt, a vote for Johnson's motion, in effect a vote against civil rights, earned a reward, as was shown by the fate of Tennessee's two senators. One of them, Albert Gore, whose sympathy for civil rights had been worrisome to the South, voted for Johnson's motion and against civil rights, and was rewarded with the Finance Committee seat he had been seeking. Tennessee's other senator, Estes Kefauver, voted against Johnson's motion and was punished. Having asked repeatedly for a seat on foreign relations since the day he arrived in the Senate, Kefauver was confident that he would inherit the seat made vacant by Walter George's retirement, since, with 8 years' seniority, he had more than any other applicant. The press and everyone else familiar with the situation was treating his appointment as a fait accompli. But when the steering committee's press release on Democratic committee assignments was dropped on the table in the Capitol press room, reporters were startled to see that the new name on foreign relations was not Estes Kefauver, but John F. Kennedy, who had only 4 years' seniority, but who was a Northerner and whose vote against tabling had therefore been anticipated and was excusable. Kefauver's reaction was restrained. "I am disappointed," he said. "Of course, I do not blame Senator Kennedy for trying to better his position. But I am interested to learn that seniority is a rule that may or may not be applied by the Senate leadership in deciding the rights of senators." Other assignments made by the steering committee met the same criteria. Johnson had been seriously considering following Jim Rowe's advice to appoint John Carroll to Judiciary, but Carroll, loyal to civil rights, had voted against his motion. He got neither Judiciary nor his second choice, Finance, for which he was considered well qualified because he had been an active member of the House's counterpart committee, Ways and Means. Instead, he was appointed to Interior, which he resented, according to his administrative assistant, Harry Schnibbe. And the loss of a committee assignment was, in some cases, only part of the punishment that Johnson inflicted for the wrong vote. As one of the newly elected senators, 32-year-old Frank Church of Idaho, was to find out. Having just taken his oath in the well of the Senate on January 3rd, Church was starting to walk back up the center aisle when, as he was passing the first desk, "I encountered this long arm of Lyndon Johnson reaching out and grabbing me." Pulling him close, Johnson said, "Now, Frank, you are the youngest member of this Senate, and you have a great future. There's lots going for you. But the first thing you ought to learn is that in Congress you get along by going along. We've got a motion here that Clint Anderson is going to offer, and it relates to a matter that is not important to your state," Johnson said. "The people of your state don't care how you vote on this one way or the other, but the leadership cares. It means a lot to me. So I just point this out to you. Your first vote is coming up, and I hope you'll keep it in mind, because I like you, and I see big things in your future, and I want for you to get off on the right foot in the Senate." Church recalls giving only a noncommittal answer, saying something like, "I would study it further," but he says, "Apparently I left Senator Johnson with the impression that I would vote with him, and he never came back to me for a second time before the vote." Since the new senator didn't understand the importance of the vote or the significance of Johnson's combined threat and promise, his studying consisted only of a casual inquiry to one or two fellow senators as to how they were voting, and when they said they were voting against tabling, Church decided to do the same. When on Friday his name was called, he shouted no. That was when Frank Church knew he had made a big mistake. From his desk in the back row, he could see Lyndon Johnson sitting below him at his front row center desk, keeping tabs on the vote on a tally sheet. "When I didn't vote with him, he threw his pen down on the desk, and I didn't see him pick it up again. I knew then that I was in deep trouble." Just how deep the youthful freshman was soon to find out. For the next 6 months, he was to recall, Lyndon Johnson never spoke to me. He said nothing to me that was insulting, he just simply ignored me. When I was present with other senators, he talked to the other senators. And one thing Johnson did not talk to him about mattered a great deal to Frank Church. Young as he was to have begun a senatorial career, he was 6 years younger than any other senator, he had already known for a long time the senatorial footsteps he wanted to walk in. The footsteps of his legendary predecessor, the Lion of Idaho. Even as a boy, Frank Church had idolized William Borah. In the eighth grade, he had written a letter to a newspaper applauding Borah's warning to avoid foreign entanglements. One of his most vivid memories was of Borah's funeral in Boise in 1940, when the 15-year-old youth had walked past the open casket. He wanted to be a senator, Church would say, because he was a senator. There was a point of resemblance between Church and Borah, the former Shakespearean actor whose Senate chamber funeral was held without a eulogy because no one could match his eloquence. Church was also a spellbinding orator who, as a high school junior, had won first prize in a national oratorical contest. Church wanted not only to walk in Bora's footprints, but to step beyond them. "He arrived here in the Senate very determined to run for president," recalls his legislative aide, Ward Hauer. He knew the Senate post that would best help him achieve both goals, the chairmanship of the Foreign Relations Committee that Bora had held for 9 years. He was aiming not just at a seat, but at the chairmanship, because that gives a senator from a small state a chance to make a name for himself, Hauer says. And Church was aware that if a senator wanted to eventually become chairman of a committee, it was important that he go on that committee early. Talking to Church a day or two before the Senate convened, Johnson had made it clear that he understood that ambition and might well be willing to help it along, not immediately, of course, but at some early opportunity. Now, suddenly, any chance of going on foreign relations seemed extremely remote. When Church attempted to make a peace overture through Bobby Baker, Baker was not encouraging. "The leader's got a long memory," he said. Johnson's tactics and methods were effective. His tabling motion had cut the ground out from under the liberal attempt to enlist Republican senators on the side of civil rights. When his motion had been voted on January 4th, only 17 Republicans had voted against it and for civil rights. 28 had voted against civil rights. 2 Republicans had been absent. And his use of raw power on his own side of the aisle had given the Southern senators additional proof of his loyalty, that he would, in fact, move on their behalf with all the determination they could desire. Only 21 Democrats had defied the leader's power by voting for civil rights. 27 Democrats had voted against civil rights. There had therefore been a total of only 38 votes for civil rights, 55 against. He had done precisely what the Southern Caucus, and particular its general, wanted. Despite the effectiveness of his tactics and methods, in the light of his longer-term goal, the overall weakness of his position had become very clear during that first week in January.